The original home to Juneteenth. Tell us, in the midst of this climate, what it means to you.
Well, it means it's sort of interesting because when it became a federal holiday, it looked like this was a chance for people on a yearly basis to talk about, an occasion to talk about slavery and the legacies of slavery. And now I want that could be in jeopardy as well. I mean, we've been celebrating this a holiday as a state holiday in Texas since 1980. This red state or this purple, you know, gerrymandered state has been celebrating Juneteenth since 1980. And the idea that we may pull back from that, or we have pulled back from that, is a little disheartening. But I think we will, you know, we will continue. I mean, people celebrated in 1875 in the end of Reconstruction every year since the day itself. So I'm continue that we will persevere. I'm assuming that we will in fact persevere and go ahead with it, but it's definitely under attack now. And this whole measure, this whole effort to take things back, roll back the civil rights movement and roll back advancements for African American people.
Annette Gordon-Reed, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Harvard history professor. Thank you. And president of the Organization of American Historians. She's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the book The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. And her most recent book is titled On Juneteenth. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Tarina Nadara, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Karl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Demento. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
On the next episode of Neuroemergent, I talk with Leah Blankenship, founder of the Neurodiversity Alliance at the University of Oregon.
Running a group entirely with neurodivergent people, it comes with its own challenges. So much of what defines academic success for these students is just being a successful adult.
Join us at 11 a.m. Wednesday, August 27th, for a conversation about neurodiversity from a Gen Z perspective.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek refuses to yield to U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi's sanctuary state demands.
There's a harmful algal bloom in several spots on the Willamette River, starting at the Ross Island Bridge, heading north.
And in international news, Palestinian journalist and reporter Bisan Auda is issuing an urgent last call for action from Gaza City. Before it is flattened, international networks are answering with a global economic strike on Thursday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 18th, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Terrence Burns. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi has issued demand letters to Oregon Governor Tina Kotek and other U.S. officials warning sanctuary jurisdictions to comply with federal orders or face consequences. Governor Tina Kotek responds today. Bondi's letter states that jurisdictions must eliminate sanctuary policies by August 19th or risk losing federal funding and potentially receive criminal prosecution. Bondi emphasized in a message on X, formerly known as Twitter, quote, "Any sanctuary jurisdiction that continues to put illegal aliens ahead of American citizens can either come to the table or see us in court, end quote. Governor Kotek's press secretary sent a response to Fox 12 on Monday saying, quote, "The governor's office is reviewing the letter, Oregon State Sanctuary Law, which was passed with strong bipartisan support in 1987 and strengthened in 2021, does not obstruct the federal government's immigration efforts. As the Oregon Department of Justice Sanctuary Guidance states, Oregon stands for the safety, dignity, and human rights of all Oregonians. Governor Kotek also states, quote, "I will fight for the safety and prosperity of every Oregonian, from recent immigrants to people who have been here for generations. We will not be bullied into doing the federal government's job of immigration enforcement." Kotek went on to say, "Threats like this undermine our values and our right to govern ourselves," end quote.
And in Washington State, Governor Bob Ferguson responded to the letter saying, quote, "Washington State has no intention of changing our values in the face of threats from the Trump administration. The federal government's relentless targeting of law-abiding immigrants is wrong," end quote. Ferguson went on to say, "Washington will maintain its commitment to keeping families together and Washingtonians safe," citing the Keep Washington Working Act that limits cooperation with federal immigration enforcement. Nationwide, the Justice Department has targeted dozens of cities and counties and states with sanctuary policies. Bondi's demands stem from an executive order issued in April directing the DOJ to identify and punish sanctuary jurisdictions. Oregon's sanctuary law, in place since 1987, prevents local cooperation with federal immigration enforcement and has withstood multiple legal challenges. Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield emphasized its longstanding legal validation and pledged to defend it. Rayfield noted that the first Trump administration in 2019 attempted to pull federal grants from the state based on its sanctuary laws, but were rebuffed by the U.S. Senate District Judge Michael J. McShane due to the administration's lack of authority to impose conditions on grants previously approved by Congress. Rayfield said, quote, "Our state sanctuary law has coexisted with seven presidential administrations, including the first Trump administration. It has been upheld by a federal court. It's my job to defend Oregon's law in court, and that it's what I intend to do," end quote. In February, the city of Portland also joined a lawsuit against the Trump administration's move to pull funding from sanctuary jurisdictions.
After public pressure from Portland's Human Access Project, the Oregon Health Authority issued a harmful algae bloom warning around Ross Island Lagoon last Tuesday. The OHA widened the alert Wednesday, going north to the Wapato Bridge in Kelly Point Park. The agency urges people and pets to stay out of the water where blooms are present. The toxins from cyanobacteria can cause headaches, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, dizziness, and fever within 24 hours and can be fatal to dogs. Two pets have already died this summer from exposure. Health officials also warn against water skiing or wakeboarding since spraying the water makes toxins easier to inhale. Boating, kayaking, and fishing are still allowed, but fish should not be eaten. This comes after the Northwest Environmental Defense Center sued the state last year, reaching a settlement that requires Ross Island sand and gravel to skim cyanobacteria and block the lagoon once an advisory is issued. Attorney Mary Sykes says the agreement was meant to protect public health during summer heat waves, but safeguards haven't been fully enforced. Willie Levinson with the Human Access Project describes the Ross Island Lagoon as looking like pea soup. He says the long-term solution is to reopen a natural channel through the lagoon to restore circulation. A bill to fund that design, this design work, failed in Salem this year. For now, public health officials stress caution. Keep pets out of the river, avoid swimming near blooms, wash thoroughly if exposed. The article was written in collaboration with X-Ray reporter Julia Moore.
A performance by the comedian Jerry Seinfeld attracted protesters in Eugene late last week. The show itself, at the Holt Center was sold out, but as attendees entered the arena, more than three dozen pro-Palestinian activists loitered by the entrances. They sang songs, handed out flyers, and held signs. The protesters criticized Seinfeld over the support of Israel in its genocide on Gaza. In a video clip earlier this year, a social media influencer asked Seinfeld to say, "Free Palestine," but Seinfeld essentially responded he didn't care about the issue. Protester Steve Deer said he was shocked by the comedian's, quote, callousness, adding he's going to tell the Holt Center, which is owned by the city, that it shouldn't be hosting performers with these views. Deer said, quote, "I encourage people who are coming to see this very talented comedian to inform themselves about what he's saying and doing, and more importantly, to center the children and people of Gaza. That's what this is about. It's not about him. It's about them," end quote. A spokesperson with Eugene's Library, Recreation, and Cultural Services said this was a rental event and that the city doesn't make rental decisions based on an artist's personal views. They said, quote, "As a public venue, our role is not to censor artists, but to ensure both the performance and the community's right to respond can coexist safely. Eugene especially has a long and treasured history of civic engagement and peaceful protest, and public dialogue is part of our community's character," end quote. Seinfeld previously responded to pro-Palestinian protesters last year, saying young activists were a little off target. He performed his stand-up without heckling or other interruption.
Paint Care helps individuals and companies in Oregon reuse their paint and makes recycled paint accessible. Isabel Charlet has more.
Summer is the peak season for home improvement projects, and experts emphasize the importance of reusing and recycling leftover paint once the work is done. Paint Care is a nonprofit organization set up by paint companies to help households and businesses recycle leftover paint statewide. Lauren Scher with Paint Care says Oregon pioneered the program in 2010, and it offers more than 180 drop-off sites throughout the state.
When people bring paint to us, we make sure that it's put to the best possible use. If it's still in good shape, it might actually get reused by somebody who could use the product as is, or it could be blended into a new recycled content paint.
To find a paint drop-off site close by, look online at paintcare.org and enter your zip code. Cher says they regularly add new drop-off sites and also host paint collection events in areas without full-time sites. To reduce waste, Cher recommends buying only what you need, which means measure first and ask for help at the store. Even with the option to recycle, she says reuse is best. Leftover gallons of paint can be used as primer for future projects, and quarts can be used for trim, furniture, or shelves. And don't forget to share extra paint with neighbors.
Give it away. If you don't have any use for it, offer it to friends or community members. And then when you've done all you can, bring it to Paint Care and recycle the rest.
Cher adds, to prolong the life of leftover paint, make sure it is sealed tightly and stored away from extreme temperatures. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
The state of Connecticut creates new rules for gun sales. Texas redistricting maps face pushback. Farah Siddiqui has more with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They need to have a reasonable cause to believe the person is either at a risk of using the firearm to harm themselves or to make sure their reasonable controls are designed to prevent the sale.
Stacey Mayer with Connecticut Against Gun Violence says a new state law holds gun makers and sellers accountable and open to lawsuits if they fail to prevent illegal or risky sales. Second Amendment groups object, but supporters say Connecticut is building on reforms since Sandy Hook, with a move intended to stop straw purchases, trafficking, and sales to prohibited buyers. In spite of Washington, D.C.'s violent crime being at a 30-year low, the Trump administration is continuing a crackdown there. Borders czar Tom Homan says deploying immigration officers in the nation's capital removes some criminals and deters others.
ICE officers are trained in police tactics too.
The move comes as former Vice President Mike Pence is voicing support for Trump's taking control of D.C. law enforcement and several GOP-led states sending National Guard troops. Texas Governor Greg Abbott is calling another special legislative session to finish redistricting. Democrats who stalemated the first session by breaking quorum now look likely to return to Austin. President Donald Trump asked state Republicans to add 5 seats in the midterms, and Abbott says the new districts comply with court rulings. But Tanya Chavez with La Unión del Pueblo Entero says they're designed to dilute the power of Latino, Black, and Asian voters.
The proposed map disrupts minority representation in Houston, South Texas, and Central Texas, and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. And the proposed map appears to have one goal, and that is to change the district just enough to force out the representative chosen by Latino voters.
Community groups in Nebraska are urging Congress to modernize decades-old immigration laws, including bypassing long-stalled legislation creating a path to citizenship for Dreamers, migrants brought to the country as children. Darcy Tromenhauser with Nebraska Appleseed says that's better for families and local economies than sudden deportations.
We need better ways to transition from temporary to permanent status for neighbors, friends, family members who've been part of local communities for 20, 30 or more years who don't have a way to apply for residency.
Michigan state regulators may see tens of thousands of public comments on a plan by Canadian energy company Enbridge to replace part of a pipeline by tunneling under the Straits of Mackinac. Native Americans and environmentalists say it's time to stop pumping the 500,000 gallons of crude a day through the 70-year-old line, where a leak could devastate drinking water, fisheries, tourism, and shipping. Massachusetts lawmakers are proposing a sweeping anti-poverty plan. The ASAP Act would expand cash benefits, tax credits, and create state-funded baby bonds for children in deep poverty with the goal of cutting hardship in half in 10 years. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a high of 78 and a low of 58. And tomorrow, we will have a high of 80 and a low of 60 degrees. Today in 1920, women won the national right to vote. Tennessee became the 36th state to ratify the 19th Amendment, ending the 72-year struggle. The quote of the day is from suffragist Abigail Scott Duniway, who fought in Oregon for the right to vote. She said, quote, "The young women of today, free to study, to speak, to write, to choose their occupations, should remember that every inch of this freedom was bought for them at a great price. It is for them to show their gratitude by helping onward the reforms of their own times, by spreading the light of freedom and truth still wider. The debt of each generation owes to the past, it must pay to the future." End quote.
A new scholarship is available at the University of Wyoming for Eastern Shoshone and Eastern, rather Northern Arapaho students. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho students will have a crack at a new scholarship at the University of Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has more.
UW is creating the Wind River Promise Fund. $250,000 will be available to tribal members to cover undergrad tuition costs and mandatory fees for full-time students. The idea has been going back and forth between tribal members, state legislators, and the university for years. UW trustee Paul Ulrich says the move is something to celebrate.
I think this is a long time coming, and I am absolutely thrilled to death that this motion has been made today.
An additional $2 million will be managed and invested like an endowment. Students must be enrolled tribal members to qualify. They also need to be Wyoming residents and graduate from a Wyoming high school. I'm Hannah Haberman.
Many clean energy initiatives across the country have been hit hard with federal funding freezes and cuts in recent months. But two villages in Alaska are considering a project that would harness the energy of ocean waves. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk reports.
Waves gently hit the shores of Kachemak Bay as ravens croak above on a cloudy night in July. The small village of Port Graham is nested here at the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. The village may soon convert wave energy into electricity. Danielle Malchev is the first chief of Port Graham.
I have a lot of hope that this is going to be something great for our community.
Chugachmute is a consortium that serves native tribes, including Port Graham and its neighbor, Nanwalik. The consortium announced it had partnered with an Australia-based company, Carnegie Clean Energy, in May. Carnegie has several wave energy projects across the world, but this would be the company's first commercial installment in the U.S. That's according to Louise Richardson, Carnegie's commercial analyst.
One thing at Carnegie that we hope our technology will be able to service in the future is remote communities and isolated communities that might not have access to other forms of renewable energy options.
Port Graham and Nanwalik have no roads connecting them to the rest of the state. Energy costs there are high because the villages are at the edge of the grid and diesel for a backup generator comes on a barge. The electrical lines running from Homer are several decades old, don't have enough capacity, and are unreliable. Malchev says the village loses power several times a month in winter and once every few months in summer.
We have to use satellite phones if our power is out, which isn't very convenient when you're trying to relay and talk to doctors in the ER and you're dealing with a patient.
Malchev says more reliable electricity from wave energy could solve some of those issues. And ideally, the villages can sell any extra energy back to the grid and use that revenue on healthcare and education. The plan is to place a wave energy device offshore from Port Graham. Permitting, testing, and installation of the project might take close to 5 years. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naidin.
Over the weekend, in a social media post, the Gathering of Nations announced its final powwow. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio has more.
In a Saturday social media post, the Gathering of Nations announced that next year's powwow will be the last dance. It's been an Albuquerque annual tradition beginning in 1983, drawing thousands of performers and spectators from across Turtle Island over the last four decades. On the event's website, organizers cited several factors beyond their control, making long-term planning and coordination challenging without specifically saying why. The 43rd Gathering of Nations will happen next April at the New Mexico State Fairgrounds. I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Early this morning in Washington, D.C., President Trump wrote on Truth Social to announce that he would lead a, quote, movement to get rid of mail-in ballots and voting machines. President Trump and his administration have expressed distaste for these voting methods since Trump's 2020 loss to former President Joe Biden. This announcement follows his recent meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska, where Putin continued to spread misinformation about the 2020 election being rigged, despite no widespread voter fraud being found. During his social media tirade, President Trump claimed that mail-in voting and voting machines lead to voter fraud. He stated, quote, I'm going to lead a movement to get rid of mail-in ballots. Also, while we're at it, highly inaccurate, very expensive, and seriously controversial voting machines, which cost 10 times more than accurate and sophisticated watermark paper, which is faster and leaves no doubt at the end of the evening as to who won and who lost the election, end quote. The president indicated that his efforts would begin with an executive order ahead of the 2026 elections, insisting that states should fall in line. Trump wrote, quote, remember, the states are merely an agent for the federal government in counting and tabulating the votes. They must do what the federal government, as represented by the President of the United States, tells them, for the good of our country, to do, end quote.
Any attempt to eliminate mail-in voting and voting machines is expected to face legal challenges aimed at stopping this executive order from taking effect before the 2026 midterm elections. Legal experts assert that the Constitution grants state legislatures the ultimate power to determine the times, places, and manners of holding elections. This is critical for protecting voters who may not be able to vote in person. Mail-in voting is particularly important for individuals with disabilities, those working hours that prevent normal voting, parents of young children, and the elderly. Studies show that fraud in mail-in voting is rare. That's thanks to safeguards like signature requirements and barcodes that track official envelopes. In 2024, Russia held elections where President Putin won in a landslide, an election widely criticized by the Western nations. The U.S. State Department remarked that the election occurred in an environment of intense political repression, which silenced independent voices. Fiona Hill, a former top advisor to Trump during his first term, commented on Trump's belief in Putin's denial of interfering in the U.S. election cycle. Hill stated, quote, "Well, look, this is Vladimir Putin, as usual, trying to manipulate U.S. domestic politics," end quote. She added that Putin, quote, "wants to sow chaos in the American electoral system ahead of the midterms," end quote.
A white man in Seattle's waterfront shot a black veteran in the chest while accusing him of claiming stolen valor. The black man, Harold Powell Sr., is wheelchair-bound and says he served in the U.S. Navy submarine service for 14 years. Powell was performing as a street entertainer at the Seattle waterfront in late July when Gregory Tim walked up to him and accused him of claiming stolen valor. Video footage shows Tim bullying Powell Sr. for several minutes before he starts grabbing Powell's things and taking his bag away from him while still taunting, quote, "Show me your ID." Powell Sr. grabs a knife out of his bag and wheels towards Tim. Tim immediately pulls his bag around and pulled out a gun. Powell can be seen grasping in his bag for something and pulling out a holstered airsoft gun as Tim shoots Powell in the chest from a few feet away. Gregory Tim claims that Powell drew the gun first, even though video surveillance clearly shows that is not true. Furthermore, Tim incited the incident. In the footage, the bystanders on the scene panic and run for cover. After shooting the gun, Tim can be heard in the video saying, quote, "It's all right, everybody," while still holding a loaded gun. There were children feet from Powell Sr., as well as dozens of bystanders. Tim is being held on $750,000 bail on felony assault charges. Tim had previously been convicted in Florida for driving a van through a tent of Trump supporters in Jacksonville, Florida. No one was injured in the event, but it drew national attention.
Palestinian reporter Bassan Auda is urgently calling for help as Israel moves on its plan to level Gaza City. In response to Bassan's call for help, the Global Anti-Apartheid Club, along with other international groups, are planning a global economic strike for Thursday, August 21st, and all Thursdays after until the genocide is stopped. They are collectively calling for everyone in the world who is paying attention to participate in an economic strike by not making any purchases of any kind this Thursday. Organizers encourage people to avoid public transportation by carpooling, cycling, or walking instead. This strike is not a work strike. The economic strike is a tactic designed to help people keep their jobs and make a difference. The goal is to make marks in the global economy until people in power are forced to address the demand for an end to the genocide. The United Nations has confirmed that Israeli forces now control 86% of Gaza. There is less than 16 square miles left for the 2.4 million Palestinians to navigate. Dozens of people are being killed daily, if not from bombings, then by extreme hunger and famine, or by the notorious aid sites that have become known as death traps. Gaza City contains some of the last standing buildings and neighborhoods in the whole of the Gaza Strip. There are about 1 million people in Gaza City. Israel is simultaneously bombing Gaza City and southern Gaza, even as they tell the entire population of Gaza to go to the south. Bassan says in a recent video, quote, If you're not speaking and doing everything right now to stop the occupation of Gaza City right now, then everything you've done over the past 2 years to stop the genocide has gone in vain and is useless.
Women make up only about 10% of fire-related workforce as a whole. A training program teaches women how to conduct prescribed burns. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Last spring, in a Nebraska prairie, workers carrying drip torches carefully burned a narrow strip of prairie grass. They were creating the perimeter for a prescribed burn, a planned fire that removes dry vegetation and reduces the risk of severe wildfire. But this was not your typical burn crew. The team was composed almost entirely of women.
In fire as a whole, we tend to see that women make up somewhere around 10% of the workforce. You know, many women who work in fire are the only woman on their entire crew. There's a lot of siloing and isolation.
Lainia Quinn Davidson directs the Women in Fire Training Exchange Program. It runs 2-week-long training events for women from various backgrounds, from professional firefighters to those who have never worked with fire. She says that as climate change increases the risk of devastating wildfires, there's a growing need for a wide range of people who understand and are trained in techniques like prescribed burning.
You want different kinds of people thinking about the problems, and you want different kinds of leadership. You want people to feel comfortable in the work so that they can operate at their best.
So she says the program is helping expand and strengthen that workforce. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation.